shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this November 15th, 2011 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org and always available via podcast. I'm your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Each week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. It's a full day crammed into one short hour this morning. I'm joined now by David Van, and in the studio with me this morning is Ellen Bell with a wonderful historical piece on Irvine called Images of America in Irvine. Coming up in the latter half of the show, Jay Asher and Carolyn Mackler will be here with their latest joint young adult novel, The Future of Us. David Van is the internationally best-selling author of Caribou Island, A Mile Down, and Legend of a Suicide, published in 17 languages and winner of 10 prizes, and selected for the New Yorker Book Club, the Times Book Club, BBC's Book at Bedtime, and more than 40 Best of the Book Year lists worldwide. Currently, he's a Guggenheim Fellow. He has been a National Endowment for the Arts Fellow and a Wallace Stegner Fellow. He's taught at Stanford, Cornell, and Florida State, and is currently an associate professor at USF. His latest work is Last Day on Earth, a portrait of the NIU school shooter, winner of the Association of Writers and Writing Programs Award for Creative Nonfiction. David, welcome back.
Thank you.
You were on with Barbara for Caribou Island in the not-too-distant past, so it's great to have you back on.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate being back on the show.
Yeah, this is great. So tell me why the NIU school shooter is a subject. How did you choose this?
I pitched a story to my editor at Esquire magazine to write about how much access kids have to guns in suburban America. When my father killed himself with a pistol when I was 13 years old, my family thought it'd be a great idea to give me all of his guns afterward. So I had a 12-gauge shotgun, a 20-gauge shotgun, a 30-30 rifle like in the Westerns, and a 300 Magnum rifle with a scope, a rifle that's meant for bears. And so, of course, at 13 years old, I used these. I snuck around at night with that 300 Magnum, and I shot out street lamps from a couple hundred yards away, and I also aimed at people through their living room windows with the scope, through the scope with a shell in the chamber and the safety off. Very scary time in which I told everyone that my father had died of cancer because his suicide was too shameful, and I didn't talk about his suicide at all. Instead, the guns became this kind of terrible substitute. And so I was curious to investigate how many kids have access to guns like that and might be living a kind of double life. I was a straight-A student by day, but I had this double life with the guns at night. So my editor at Esquire, when he heard that pitch, told me instead about this school shooting where the shooter had been a straight-A student and no one could make any sense of what happened. It was at Northern Illinois University near Chicago, Valentine's Day 2008, and my editor thought of me. He said, "You're just like this mass murderer. Why don't you write about him? You had the kind of strange double life with guns and all that." So nice of him to think of me when reading about the mass murderer. And I had actually no interest in school shooters, mass murderers. I had never read a book about one and never imagined writing one. But I was lucky in investigating the story in that I was a professor, not a journalist. So his professors and friends would talk to me, even though they wouldn't talk to any other media. And I spent a couple weeks with them and found out they just didn't know anything. And so I went back to his junior high and high school friends, and back then, his life was really perfectly shaped for mass murder. You could see all the warning signs in the world. You could see a terrible mental health history that came after high school and junior high, multiple suicide attempts. Really every warning sign you could expect to see. But he had reshaped himself over the 5 years of undergrad and then grad school, and that's why his killing didn't make any sense to the people who knew him at the end. So I had these earlier interviews. I read all the books he was reading, watched all the movies he was watching. I put together readings of all of them and shared those with law enforcement. I did, in effect, what an FBI profiler would do. And so in return, the law enforcement agencies gave me the full access to 1,500 pages of the police files, which had everything completely unedited, his mental health history, every comment ever made about him by a therapist, his emails with girlfriends and such, his military record, his juvenile record, everything. So I had this mountain of facts. So I ended up with the full files, really complete portrait, access to everything. every interview that law enforcement had ever done, and then 3 months of interviews that I did. And, you know, it's a terrible and ugly story, but I think it's a useful one because it really is a mountain of facts, and it's everything about him. And I think that his story implicates us and American culture in some way and makes it clear why and who these school shooters are.
So is there a sense that he was always on this path, that this was always going to end the way it did, or was this reinvention that he did in the last 5 years of his life trying to pull himself out of it, and he was just unsuccessful at doing that?
Yeah, it's terrible that the shooting happened at NIU, because NIU actually is kind of a testament to how a university can change a person's life and make them not become a shooter. And so it's awful that they had to then have the shooting happen in their university. Because really, he tried. The most interesting part about his story is that he didn't want to become a shooter. He really wanted to reshape his life, and he was a good tutor of other students. He was helping people. He was an A student. He got the Dean's Award at the end of his undergraduate years, which is the highest award an undergrad could get there. So he had this tremendous drive for success and was off the medications, all the prescription medications that he'd had in high school and then his years in a mental health system afterward near Chicago. And what happened to make him regress to who he had been before is that he went through transitions, which are often tough for people with mental health issues, especially when they're on their own. He switched to a different university 3 hours away for grad school, so he's kind of leaving his professors and friends. His mother died, and that had been an angry, terrible relationship and was now unresolved. And his last semester of classes wouldn't count, so instead of getting straight A's, he just stopped going to class, and he got F's, and he went to the shooting range and shot things instead. So again, the guns became a kind of substitute.
Right, right. My guest this morning is David Vann, and the book is Last Day on Earth. So I'm trying to I'm trying to wrap my mind around how much information you had. So the shooting happened in early 2008. Obviously, the book is already written out and circulating. So the mound of information you had, the mound of, you know, I mean, in addition to the gigantic police transcript and sifting through all of these interviews and everything else that you did, wrapping your arms around this and shaping it into a story. Tell me a little bit about kind of that process. Did you set up kind of a timeline of his life where events happened, or how did you kind of go about the process of accumulating this massive amount of material and then shaping it into a story?
Well, it was really a collaboration with my editor at Esquire, Tyler Cabot. He was fantastic. I talked with him on the phone every day throughout all the interview and investigation process. And together, we both were looking at these files. And by the end of that, just the first months of doing the story, the 3 months from, say, April, May, June of 2008, I had more than 1,000 pages almost memorized. When we asked about any piece of information or were talking about it, I could see it, which page it was on and kind of which corner of the page, just because that was all my life was. This is all I did for those months. And Esquire was holding the issue, their August 2008 issue. They were holding it back 3 weeks late to go to press. So I had to write 22,000 words in 6 days. So I wrote 80 pages in 6 days, which I just thought was going to kill me. It was terrible to try to write that many pages based on all of this information in such a short period of time. And then the next 6 days after that, I had to cut it down to 12,500 words from 22,000, which is what it ran at. And then 6 days after that of all the fact-checking, going back over those 1,500 pages of files and all the interviews to make sure everything was right. And so it was really Esquire who put me through the paces on this you know, project that I wouldn't have done in that way myself. It was kind of exciting, but this material was so dark. I watched the Saw movies, for instance, which were his favorite movies, along with Fight Club. And in the Saw movies, it's a pseudo-therapist who's really a sadistic killer who's torturing people to teach them the value of their lives. And, you know, it's just gross. And Fight Club, with the kind of ambivalent male sexuality where he's gay but doesn't want to be gay, and he's in a libertarian army of maggots erasing any tracking of the individual. And, you know, just finding out about libertarian philosophy and politics and how ugly that is and how it's shared by all the shooters, looking at his racism, his interest in other shooters. This was just all so dark, so nasty that I wanted it out of my head. So I wrote the rest of the book in 6 weeks, faster than I've ever written a book before. So I finished it by the fall of 2008. And it could have been published right away, but there were various delays and actually attempts to kill the book, too. So that's why it's coming out so late, actually.
Wow. Wow. And was it always in place that you were going to do this interweave of sort of memoir with biography?
That was my intention from the first, to include my story along with Steve's, because I wanted to not make him a monster. The recent movie, We Need to Talk About Kevin, is really not helpful for thinking about school shootings, because he's just born demonic from the first. And so he doesn't implicate us in any way. He doesn't say anything about American culture. He's just evil from the moment he's born. He does his killing with a bow, and so we don't have to talk about guns, and we need to talk about Kevin. All of our school shootings are, of course, with guns, and guns are a major issue, and we're insane about guns in the U.S. So I wanted to keep him close, and I wanted his story to implicate us as much as possible, because the truth is that a school shooting is nothing in the U.S. We shouldn't even be focusing on it. It was 6 deaths, 18 wounded. One weekend while I was in Chicago reporting this, there were 33 shootings with 9 homicides, and an AK-47 was used in one of the shootings. That was just one weekend, and that manages to not be a story. We have 10,000 handgun deaths in this country a year, 33,000 suicides, half with firearms. We're so deeply insane and in denial, not able to talk about issues that are related to what's in this book, that really it's crazy that, the story that became crazy was not Steve's story, but America's story.
Yeah, right.
And so I wanted my memoir in there because I was very close. I was a very scary kid. You know, I was 13 years old, straight-A student. I would be valedictorian. Everyone thought I was this little angel. But I'm sneaking around at night with 300 Magnum sighting in on people in their living rooms. And I actually contemplated a school shooting at one point. So I think it's important to think about gun culture and availability of guns. And then all the other factors that led to this shooting. Steve was in the military, and all of our shooters who are old enough to have served in the military have, because the military teaches you how to use weapons and also teaches you how to kill without emotional or psychological response. That's actually the goal. And Steve talked about that with his best friend several times, that's what they had taught him. We currently have 1.2 million American veterans seeking mental health help. And we only have 20,000 people to help them with their mental health. And they're mostly in large urban centers and not scattered in all the various towns where our veterans live. So in other words, we haven't addressed that issue of mental health need that all these people have who have been trained in weapons and trained to kill without any emotional or psychological response. Like, that's a very scary story in America, much scarier than a school shooting.
No. My guest this morning is David Vann. The book is The Last Day on Earth. Was there a sense that there was a tipping point for you and for Steve where there was the fork in the road and you chose to go one way and he chose to go the other? Could you, again, going through his story and in revisiting your own, could you kind of identify where that tipping point was for the two of you to make the opposite decisions?
I think that a lot of it, I'm hesitant to say this, a lot of it goes to the difference in our families. And I'm hesitant to say that because in America we want to believe that everything's affected just by our families, that statistics and larger politics such as our access to guns and lack of gun control won't have any effect on us. And when we look at school shootings, we think of family connections, family values, and we think of bullying for kids who are younger in schools. And that enables us to avoid the larger issues of what lead to these shootings. But it is true, of course, that all the shooters become isolated from their families, angry, their families isolated from their friends. And I had a much better network in that way. My mother was really different than Steve's mother, you know, so it goes clear back to that. His mother was showing him horror films and was undiagnosed but probably mentally ill. My mother was encouraging me to do my homework, looking at drafts of my essays, and you know, very supportive and great in all ways. So that was, you know, probably a basic difference that made all the difference. He also has his mental health history starts in high school with an attempt at suicide, and he's given a lot of medications, including lithium, and was puffed up to 300 pounds after being skinny. And in just a couple of months, he gained all that weight. And the problem with all the medications are that in the mental health system, often patients are given cocktails of medications. And so the doctors and the patient, no one knows what effect is from which medication. And they also don't know what effects are part of the person and what effects are part of just the medications or just the side effects. So when Steve had psychotic visions, for instance, is that just from the medications or was he actually going to have psychotic visions himself? And so I stopped being able to identify my life with Steve's life as he goes on the medications. He actually becomes something other than human when he's on all the medications. He just goes off the map. And that's true for a lot of people in our mental health system. It's really hard to find out who they are after they've been on a cocktail.
Right, right. Were some of the people involved in this, his girlfriend, his roommate, were they reluctant subjects to interview, or were they pretty
open? Yeah, she lied to me at every turn. As much as she could possibly lie to me, she did. And she sealed the story a couple days after the shooting. Her name's Jessica Beatty. She had been his girlfriend, and she was his roommate and friend at the time. But she went on CNN and as the girlfriend, planning to get married with him, and just said that he was a sweet, innocent guy. He would never do this. You know, no, Steve couldn't do this. And that sealed the story. That just killed the story. From then on, he was just a sweet grad student who snapped. Which is awful, because actually his life was pretty perfectly shaped for mass murder. There are all kinds of warning signs, and she was the one person who could have seen all of them. And all of those warning signs tell us something about American culture, and these are things that we need to learn and need to pay attention to. So it was awful that the story was crushed in that way, and that's why I felt it was worthwhile to have the book come out, which has all the information and has the truth about him, even if it's ugly. I think it's worth seeing it once to understand who these shooters are, because they're easily profiled. They all share the same characteristics. I mean, that's the crazy thing to me. It's so easy to profile who the school shooters are, but the problem is we can't do anything about the profile. So the shooter will be a man, for instance. He won't have a lot of money. His politics will be libertarian. If he's old enough to have served in the military, he will have. He'll most likely have a mental health history. He'll like horror movies and enjoy talking about shooters. They all buy from the same online suppliers, like he bought from the same one that VA Tech did, and used the same weapon, the Glock 19 that was also used at VA Tech and used in Tucson. They're triggered by each other's events. There had been a shooting right before that made him decide to do his 11 days beforehand, and then, of course, he buys all the stuff online in a big spree. It's not hard, actually, to say who they are. And most of our school shooters, or many of them, are not actually students in the school at the time, but they go back to schools or go to schools they've never been to do their shootings. Schools are a site for shootings, and we need to look beyond just the students who are there. So the problem with all these warning signs are that we can't do anything about any of them. Because of the Second Amendment and the recent Supreme Court ruling, which has rolled back limitations on handgun ownership, for instance, in Washington, D.C. and in Chicago, our only way toward reasonable gun control in this country at this point is to actually repeal the Second Amendment. And you can imagine how tough that would be to do. It's very hard to have guns not end up in the hands of veterans who have mental health issues, because it seems very unpatriotic and anti-American to say that a veteran can't have a gun after serving their country with guns abroad. It also, with the American Disabilities Act, it's hard to not have someone with a mental health history allowed to own a firearm. Poverty is certainly not a crime. Libertarian philosophy, we can't round up libertarians. So all these warning signs, when you put them together, I find it very disheartening working on this book, because it's very easy to see who the shooters are. It's very easy to see who we should be afraid of, but we can't do anything about it, as far as I can tell.
All right. My guest this morning is David Vann. The book is The Last Day on Earth. Maybe we'll go out with you reading to the, from us from the book.
Okay, so this is the day that he's planning to go to the shooting. Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2008. I imagine Steve sitting on the end of his bed in the broken-down travelodge, smoking in Newport, stale smell of old cigarettes of all the lives that have passed through this room. I know he's dressed in black shoes, black pants, his black T-shirt with terrorist in white letters above a red AK-47 assault rifle, black stocking cap with dark eyes, a narrow face, small mouth, almost no chin. His eyebrows are plucked. He shaved his pubic hair, and that's because he liked Marilyn Manson's androgyny. All the shooters are big fans of Marilyn Manson, and his words kind of confuse suicide and murder constantly. Across his lap, the Remington 12-gauge shotgun, the barrel sawed off, one hand on the stock, one on the barrel. He can't sit still, though, always fidgeting. Beside him, laid out carefully across the bedspread, all pointing the same way, three pistols, Glock 9mm, Sig Sauer 380, High Point 380. He picks up the Glock, checks the clip, makes sure it's full, checks it again. Threes have always spoken to him, shown him what to do. Three pistols, three shells in the shotgun. He could take out the duck plug, make it five shells, but then it wouldn't be three. The Glock doesn't seem real, heavy, but looks like plastic, feels like plastic, a toy gun almost. He sets the pistol down, picks up the next and the next, checks each clip three times, checks the extra clips. A bullet is so small, so heavy for its size. Waiting, takes another drink of Red Bull, pushes up the sleeve on his right forearm, looks at his tattoo again, jigsaw riding a tricycle through a pool of blood, cut marks in the background. He lays the shotgun in his guitar case, closes the latches, tucks all three pistols into his holsters, along with extra clips in their pouches, everything hidden by his coat. Kenneth Cole, not a trench coat exactly, nicer. Checks himself in the mirror, walks to the door, then has to go back to check again just to make sure, always checking. He had a lot of obsessive-compulsive symptoms. I should explain, I realize, as I read this. He turns right out of the motel lot, just a white Honda Civic, nothing you'd notice. Left on Carroll Ave, left into the guest parking lot. He parks a couple hundred feet from Cole Hall, a cold, overcast day, snow. Listens to a CD the police will find in his stereo. He's titled it Final CD. Waits for the last song, Manson's Last Day on Earth. Class will be over soon. He must know that. Has he hesitated? Has he sat there in his car listening to music and considered not going through with it? He's almost too late. A few more minutes, only a few more, and everyone will be gone. Does it occur to him that what he's about to do is not inevitable, even for a life like his, so perfectly shaped for mass murder? One last song. I know it's the last day on earth. Say goodbye. Then he gets out of the car, grabs the guitar case, puts on a small black backpack to make it look like he's carrying books for classes, and walks the short distance to the back of Cole Hall. It's all brick, and there's a walkway here between the two auditoriums. He's close to the door that will take him backstage. He drops the backpack, opens the guitar case, picks up the shotgun, checks his pistols.
David Venn reading from The Last Day on Earth, a portrait of the NIU school shooter. David, we've run out of time, but this was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on the show again. I really appreciate it.
This was fantastic. Thanks.
Thank you.
That was David Venn. The book is The Last Day on Earth, A Portrait of the NIU School Shooter. It is out and available. It is fascinating. Well, you know, I love that reading. I love the clipped sentences that that he does, you know, the reporter style, the very short, you know, factual, not commentating on what's happening, just giving us the very short, chilling facts. That was fantastic. So I was lucky enough to be joined in studio today by one of Barbara's friends, students, and fellow writers, and I had to take advantage of it. So Ellen Bell is a freelance writer who has the great fortune of being able to follow what interests her. For the past 3 years, she has written the Afternoon Angel blog of the OC Register Sports. She's also a contributing writer for Orange Coast Magazine, OC Family Magazine, and OC Register Travel. Her book, Lake Lawn, was published by Arcadia in 2009, and her latest is Irvine, Images of America, also published by Arcadia. It is my huge pleasure to have her on this morning. Ellen, welcome.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
It's great to have you here. I never have people in the studio, so this is extra fun. This is extra fun. So tell me a little bit about getting your foot in the freelance door and kind of keeping it there. Tell me a little bit about how you got started writing for all of the OC publications.
Well, I think the key to writing freelance work or any kind of writing is just to write what interests you. I started writing, of all things, about baseball, and I never would have intended to become a person who writes about baseball, but I'm a huge baseball fan and had the opportunity to write about my passion for the Angels, for the OCRegister.com their web page and started writing an afternoon angel blog for them. And it basically just came out of my love for that topic. And I think that's what writing is. It's just what we're passionate about. And that's when we'll be the most honest and the most interesting and when our voice will be clearest. So I started doing that. And I think the other key is finding a good group of a support group for writing. And I'm in a great writing support group. We call ourselves the Literary Posse, and we meet every Wednesday. And that's a key element because it's a way to get some of these thoughts and ideas and passions out of your head and onto paper and in a group of kindred spirits who support you. And once we work together on pieces, then the key is just to send them out. So many of the times, I think, when we want to do freelance work, we're afraid to send them in, afraid to pitch our ideas. And that really is an unfounded fear. There's so many opportunities, and I've found great audiences and places to submit my work in Orange County here, and people who've been really open to new voices and new ideas. And the key is just having something that you feel really strongly about to say.
Actually, you know, as we were chatting about this earlier, it strikes me that Orange County is actually a uniquely kind of great place to be writing, because the community of writers here seems, I mean, submitting things in New York or LA or Chicago seem like you're not going to get the editorial response that you get from people here who seem like they take the time and read your work and give you thoughtful critiques.
I think that's right. I think it's much more of a smaller town atmosphere, but with great opportunity as well. There's some wonderful writers and editors and people who are very encouraging. Orange Coast Magazine is a great opportunity for people who maybe new to writing, maybe have just been writing things on their own and haven't had a chance to really submit them out there for a greater audience. And they are very open to people submitting things to them. Their MyOCSA is a great venue for that. And they just want to hear great stories about people's ideas and living in Orange County. And I found it to be a wonderful opportunity. Great critiques, great feedback. And I would encourage anybody to submit things there.
So tell me how that translated into the longer works in writing for Arcadia.
Well, I got involved with Arcadia basically out of my love for history, and I've kind of always had this passion for preservation. My dad was a history teacher, and we spent all our vacations kind of traveling around Civil War battlefields and camping and things like that. And so there was a place back in the Midwest where I grew up, a historic place that I was kind of horrified there wasn't any preservation of the history of this place, and I wanted to do something about it. So I pitched my idea to Arcadia, and they accepted it, and I wrote this book, Lake Lawn, 2 years ago. And that was a wonderful adventure, really, and just being able to discover even more about a place that I thought I knew. And so when I finished that project, I wanted to write about something closer to home, and there hadn't been a book written about Irvine. And it's funny because so many people think that Irvine doesn't have history, being only 40 years old as a city, and I kind of wanted to find out the real truth behind that. And I started digging, and Arcadia was very, very encouraging about having the project, and learned all kinds of new things about the city that I've lived in for the last 20 years.
Yeah, where did you go? What do you do? Tell me a little bit about the research process.
Well, this project was unique in the fact that there was already a lot written about Irvine. I mean, it's not really an unknown topic as far as historical research, but it's more just in the public. People don't know all the history that's there. And so I went digging. I went to the UCI Special Collections Library. They were very helpful. I went to the Orange County Archives, Bowers Museum. Probably my greatest source was the Irvine Historical Museum itself. Irvine has this great resource, a wonderful museum on the San Joaquin Golf Course in Irvine. And so I spent many hours just going through file cabinets of old images and going through files and old articles and books, and had a wonderful time just, you know, holed up in with these archives, learning all about things I didn't know about my own town.
The book is beautiful.
Thank you.
How many photographs are in here?
It's over 200 photographs, and I actually had a hard time narrowing it down to that. I got near the end of the book or the research of it and realized I probably could have done two.
Yeah.
And divided it down to like early to post-war and then after that. So maybe I'll have to do another one. But
yeah, I was going to say, are you done with Irvine?
I don't think so. I think, you know, it's funny. One project always leads to another. And so many people have shared their stories with me about Irvine. And I really would like to do one where I talk a little more to the people who were here when Irvine became a city. I think that's one area that I didn't get a chance to investigate as much as I would like to. And there's some wonderful pictures in the book about early UCI, early Irvine, when it was being incorporated in 1970. The city has changed so dramatically, even in just the last 30, 40 years, just in how it looks. And so this is one of the only places to see how Irvine used to be not too long ago. Mm-hmm. And so many people have shared their ideas that it might be good to do a book about a little more text-oriented, about people's stories about developing the villages and what it was like to live here, the school boards, the city council meetings and all of that. There's a lot of great stuff there.
Yeah. I've only been here 14 years, and it's changed a lot.
It changes all the time.
It's all the time, I know.
And that's an Orange County phenomenon, really. I mean, we live in a place that is so new and is changing and reinventing itself all of the time. And that's why these local history books, I mean, they have them about all the little local communities around here. I think they're very valuable because so many people don't have a sense of the rich heritage that really has been here and that caused the cities that we live in. I mean, they didn't happen by accident. They all kind of had a plan and they all developed because of the people who were here before.
Yeah. Fantastic. And you have an event coming up?
I do. It'll be fun. It'll be this Sunday, the 20th. We're going to be getting together over at Britta's Cafe at UCI across the way here at the Marketplace. And Britta's a wonderful supporter of Irvine. And so we'll be there in the afternoon from 4 to 6. So I'd love to see if you'd come by.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Ellen Bell, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I will be here with Jay Asher and Carolyn Mackler. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we will be right back.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My baby just cares for
races my baby don't care for. Hightown places, Liz Taylor is not a star high, and even Lana Turner smile. Something he can't see. My baby don't care. Who knows? My baby just cares for me.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI, 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Feel free to visit iTunes. We are under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website at penonfire.com for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. Had a fantastic speaker series event last night with Meryl Marco and Karen Carbo, and they always remind me of how much fun they are, how quickly they sell out. We were totally oversold, and people were standing in the wings. And how great the OC literary community is. It was huge fun. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined now by Jay Asher and Carolyn Mackler. Jay Asher's first novel, 13 Reasons Why, spent over a year on the New York Times bestseller list, with foreign rights sold in over 30 countries and more than a million copies in print in the U.S. alone. He was on with Barbara not terribly long ago talking about that novel. Carolyn Mackler is the Prince Honor-winning author of The Earth, My Butt, and Other Big Round Things, Tangled, Gaiaholic, Vegan Virgin Valentine, and Love and Other Four-Letter Words. Her novels have been published in over 15 countries. Their joint book is the young adult novel The Future of Us. It's published by Razorbill, a division of Penguin, and we will chat about it this morning. Hello, guys.
Hi.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Oh, this is fun. I haven't had a couple of people on in a long time, so this is, it's a morning of rare firsts. I love this.
Thank you.
So, Carolyn, why don't you start and just sort of introduce us to the novel and what inspired it?
Well, what inspired it is about a year and a half ago, I was speaking on a panel at the New York Public Library. I live in New York City. And an audience member asked me, what would your dream project be? And without even thinking about my answer, which I really generally don't recommend, but in this case I definitely recommend, I said, I want to write a collaborative young adult novel. And afterwards I thought, wow, I want to write a collaborative young adult novel. Who would I want to write it with? And immediately I thought of Jay. I was a huge fan of 13 Reasons Why. We didn't know each other, had just exchanged a few emails after he had given a wonderful quote from my last book, Tangled. And I emailed him soon after and said, hey, I've got a crazy idea to run by you. And he wrote back and said, anytime's a good time for crazy ideas. And 8 days later, we had the full concept of The Future of Us.
Amazing, amazing. Is that sort of your version of it too, Jay, or do you have a different take on it?
That's pretty much what happened,
yeah. So it strikes me as really daunting to write a collaborative book. I mean, it's hard enough to write a book, you know. I mean, my own mind is hard enough to piece things together. Tell me a little bit about how the collaboration went. It sounds like there was an outline, because it sounds like you had something to work from in 8 days there. So tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it went amazingly smooth, which was very weird. Neither of us had ever written with anybody before, so we didn't know how it was going to go. Basically, yeah, we brainstormed the whole novel. We especially chapter by chapter, we knew what was going to be worked on by the other author each step of the way. And so we divvied the book up, and Carolyn would write a chapter and send it to me. And basically, we both wanted to have complete control of everything. So she would send her chapter to me, and then I basically had free rein to edit it at will, add things, take things out, and didn't even tell her what I was doing. I just did it and then sent it back to her, and we would slowly work through each chapter, and some chapters were sent back and forth over 20 times until we were both happy, thinking, yes, this is the chapter we want, and we moved through the whole book that way.
And that was something we decided on before we even started. Our first conversation wasn't, what are we going to write about? It was, could we work together? Mm-hmm. And what we both said is, if we ever did write a collaborative novel, we would want to feel like it was written by one person. We would want it to feel seamless. And we also felt like we're both really wanted to be as obsessive as we wanted to be about every word, every bit of dialogue, how the story was going. And so we realized that we could both do that, that we would agree that we could rewrite each other's. We could really kind of check our egos at the door while we were writing this book.
Now, I'm going to go out on a limb and guess that Carolyn wrote Emma's sections and Jay wrote Josh's sections. Is that true?
Yeah.
That's
true. That's how we initially wrote it.
First draft.
Although there were times where one of us, and I'm not going to say who, but it was Carolyn, would get carried away, and she would write one of Emma's chapters and just be on a roll and really know exactly what should happen in Josh's. So then all of a sudden she would write Josh's chapter.
I left a very nervous voicemail on Jay's phone one day. I was walking home from the library where I was writing, and I said, I have to admit to you that I finished Emma's, and I just knew exactly where Josh's was going to go, and I wrote half of it, and don't hate me. And he left me a message back and said, that's okay, but don't keep doing that because I might just get lazy. So... But we did. Sometimes I would be working on Emma, and I just wouldn't know how to describe something that she was thinking or feeling, and I would send it to Jay and just say, can you just take this for a little while, because I'm not sure how to do it. And so we really did, even though we originated sort of most of the first drafts of I wrote Emma, Jay wrote Josh, we really did do a little bit of switching back and forth whenever we needed to.
And it's pretty linearly written, you know, where one chapter leaves off, the next one sort of picks up and runs with the ball. And was that structure sort of always in place, that you knew you just kind of had to keep moving forward in time like that?
Yeah. I mean, the book only takes place over 1 week,
right?
In these characters' lives. And so there's a definite momentum because of that, that we wanted it to feel very, very much like you just keep pushing forward.
Right, right.
Go ahead.
We
knew that there was just going to be so much tension in the discovery of these characters seeing their Facebook profiles 15 years in the future and not knowing what Facebook is, or suddenly realizing that they're seeing the adults they became. We knew that there was just so much intrinsic tension there that as we were writing, we could feel the tension. Like, and we would always think about, where's the best place to leave off where someone's just going to want to turn the page?
I'm realizing we haven't introduced the book to our poor audience, who has no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah,
Jay, can you tell us a little bit about the kind of the scope and idea of the book?
Yeah, so The Future of Us is set in 1996, so that's long before social networking, anybody had even heard of it. And Josh and Emma are next-door neighbors in high school, and they've grown up with each other. And one day, Emma gets a new computer, and Josh brings over one of those America Online CD-ROMs with 100 free hours. And during the download of AOL, something weird starts happening, and her computer starts flashing, and all of a sudden, Facebook appears, which they have no idea what it is at first, except the woman in the upper corner looks a lot like Emma might look 15 years in the future. And they realize that's exactly what happened. They have a glimpse into their future, who they marry, their careers, and then those status updates, which for Emma, it looks like she does not have a very happy future. And Josh finds out he's married to the hottest girl in school. So they have different ideas of what they want to do with this information, whether it's change the future or keep things exactly the same.
I was struck that, you know, I've forgotten how fast the world has changed, that in 1996, over half of the high school students had never logged onto the internet. I just, you know, it took me a while to wrap my brain around that. Tell me about choosing the 1996 time period.
I mean, 1996 felt like the perfect year to pick because it was the cusp of so much technology exploding. I mean, it was a time when it felt like it could be a choice whether or not you were going to try out the internet, and whether or not you might even think about getting a beeper, or whether or not you might be available at all times. And a lot of people hadn't sent an email, hadn't received an instant message. So, but it was there. I mean, there was a bit of access, and people, a lot of people had home computers and a dial-up. So it felt like a time when we could conceivably have our characters somehow access Facebook, you know, via dial-up, but also it was a time when it was all so foreign. Like, if we hit it, you know, if we set the book in 2000, then it might feel a little more realistic. think that our characters would understand a social networking site. But it was a time when they were looking at it like it was a completely foreign entity.
Was there any research to do to try and take, because I was trying to take myself back to 1996, even though it wasn't that long ago, trying to think exactly what did exist and what didn't exist.
Yeah, we found a lot of websites that talked about, you know, different events that happened that were going on in the world at the time and the technology from back then and what was and wasn't available. And it was fascinating because, just like you said, we were kind of shocked sometimes when, oh, yeah, there was none of this. Or, and it's not that long ago, and yet it seems so innocent now when you look back at it.
I mean, there were things like we were having, you know, Josh at some point is sitting in the car of Sydney Mills, the woman who, you know, and they're, you know, as teenagers, the woman who he will one day probably marry, because they start getting to know each other once he realizes he may eventually marry her. He's sitting in her car, and she leaves her cell phone on the dashboard in 1996, and he's eyeing the phone, and I think we were trying to figure out what he does with the phone. Does it flip open? And so we were looking at a bunch of pictures online of phones from 1996, and they're just huge.
Huge.
An antenna coming up the top. And so it was funny because I think our automatic was like, oh, it would just be a flip open phone. And we're like, well, maybe it wouldn't. And so we really did sort of track down a bunch of just photographs and timelines from that year.
Now, you guys don't live anywhere close to each other. Carolyn, you're in New York. And Jay, you must be up in Santa Barbara or something, right?
I'm in California. Yeah, just north of Santa Barbara.
Yeah. So did that pose any problems, or is everything so, I mean, it's sort of a mirror of this book, right? The future is now, and you guys don't need to be on the same coast to write a book together.
We couldn't have written this book in 1996.
Right.
At least
we
not as fast as we did.
We probably couldn't have written this book in the same time zone.
Really?
It was so helpful that we had this 3-hour lag, because Jay would write at night at West Coast time and email me a chapter. And when I'd wake up in the morning, I work in the mornings, I would be able to work on it. And Jay may have just sent it to me like 20 minutes before I got it, you know, East Coast time. So it really did work that we had this weird sort of time-space continuum going on while we were writing the book.
That was fantastic. What was the, a couple of the challenges, the hardest part of doing this, either together or just the project in general?
Actually, it's really odd. There actually weren't that many challenges. We, you know, like Carolyn said, we talked pretty extensively at the very beginning about what we liked and didn't like about books and storytelling and just the writing process. And we're very, very similar when it comes to those things. So it was, you know, I think that brainstorming and everything just went faster than had I been doing it alone, because as opposed to trying to come up with solutions by myself, you know, I would bounce things off of Carolyn. She would do the same with me, and then we would just get to the solutions much quicker.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, especially during the first draft, when we were writing it, we didn't butt heads at all, I don't think. It just went very smoothly.
It went really smooth. I would say the one challenge, though, is the speed at which we wrote it, because once we thought of the idea and really knew that we had these two teenagers, a boy and a girl, sort of having such opposite reactions to seeing their futures and seeing them on Facebook, we just thought the idea was so cool. Like, after we hung up the phone, when we decided on that idea, we both just were sort of trembling with, like, okay, we've got to do this. Then I think we just felt this breakneck speed, like we wanted to get it out. And so we had to sort of be able to write fast, work with each other, read each other stuff, and at some points we were just working so fast, like our eyes were blurry from writing. And
part of the reason for that speed was, a month before Carolyn emailed me, my wife and I found out we were pregnant with our first child.
Oh,
and we, Jay and his wife.
Right. Carolyn actually has two sons, so she told me, you know, I know what this is like, and once he arrives, you're going to be out of commission for a while, so we have to do this before he arrives. And as it turned out, we turned in the first draft the day my wife went into labor. It just happened to work out that way.
That's actually an artificial deadline like that. That's fantastic. I love that.
Yeah, I stopped referring to my
son as a chicken
time bomb.
Like, it felt like a really hard deadline.
Bomb,
like, you know, the speed at which we were writing, you just couldn't do that with an infant in the house. And so, I think we had this, like, it was right around now last year. It was, you know, Jay's wife was, what was she at this point? You know, 37 weeks pregnant, and we weren't done with the book yet. And we were just, you know, writing 17-hour days. hoping her water didn't break.
I knew this had to be fast because 13 Reasons Why didn't come out that long ago, right? I mean,
no, it came out in 2007.
Seven? Oh, it did. Okay, all right.
Yeah,
all right.
But yeah, she contacted me, and we still remember the dates. April 5th is when she sent the initial email, and December 9th is when we turned in the first
Wow.
Round.
Wow. Of the same year?
Yeah.
Oh, my. Wow. That's impressive.
And we only met one time in the writing. I was speaking at a conference, a children's writers conference in Los Angeles, and that Jay attends every year. And it was, we were about 100 pages into the book when we actually met face-to-face. So it was really funny. It was like we'd already written so much together, and then we sort of met at a cocktail party, and it was like, hi, we're writing a book together. but it was actually great because we had a lot of sort of bigger issues to discuss that, you know, sort of like the, what do our characters in the future know about what they saw as teenagers? So we really got to sit down and have a lot of meals together, and we had just a big piece of paper with arrows and lines and scribbles all over it, and we were able to work out some more of the nuts and bolts of the book.
Now, do you think
that was the only time we met in the whole writing until it was done.
That's amazing. And do you do the tour together and everything, or do you?
We're going to be doing a tour together in January.
Yeah, okay.
Which is going to be interesting. I've been on a couple tours by myself, and it's going to be so much less lonely having somebody to talk to.
And also, you only have to speak 50% of the time. I find that when I sort of trail off, Jay can just pick up.
Yeah.
If you, if you're staring off into space, you've got somebody that has your back. I love that. Now, were you each responsible for your own character development? Were you kind of responsible for shaping Emma, Carolyn?
It was all a conversation. I mean, that's what was so much fun, is that I did say to Jay at some point, oh, I think, you know, Emma should have curly hair and she should play a musical instrument. But it was a conversation. And the funny thing is that we started this book, as I said, like not knowing each other. And as we were developing our characters, sometimes we'd be talking about the character and then we would just sort of start segue into talking about our own teen years and some of the humiliating moments and the wonderful moments and just different things that happened to us. And we'd sort of talk about our own, you know, our own lives and how that might, you know, sort of inform various characters. And so really a lot of developing Emma and Josh was part of just a conversation about life and ourselves and who these people should be. And it helps so much being able to develop a character together.
Yeah.
Well, and especially, you know, for both of us, like when I was writing Josh's character, I would have to include Emma's character in some of her dialogue. And so sometimes I would have Emma say something. I remember at one point in particular that when Carolyn ended up reading it, she said, wow, Emma said that in a much more pointed way than I would have written it. But I think that's
right?
Appropriate, you know. And so
was it the part with the fingernails, Jay?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, it was so sassy. And I think that I was writing Emma a little more timid. And then when I saw Jay wrote Emma's dialogue in Josh's chapter, he had to capture her voice, but he made her voice a little more fierce. And I think it was a part about sharpening fingernails and scratching someone. And I thought, okay, let's go back. And I looped back, and I was able to add a little more of that sass to Emma's personality. So it was fun how we sort of informed each other's characters just through writing our own chapters.
Right, right. Will you both or either of you do this again? Do another collaborative project again?
It's so weird because it was a much easier writing experience than I've experienced before. So it's very, very tempting. I don't think I could write another novel with somebody else because this went so smooth. I would constantly be comparing that person to Carolyn, going, you're not as fun as writing with Carolyn. And that would be unfair.
I feel the same way. I really do. I feel like Jay and I were, I mean, it's just a funny thing that we were meant to be writing partners. I mean, it was so smooth and it was so fun and effortless that it just seems like we've got to work together again. I mean, even when we exchange emails, we think, this is just really fun. We should do this.
Yeah. What a sweet story. What a sweet backstory. I love this. Any last minute words of writing advice for writers on collaborating or otherwise?
You know, whenever people ask for writing advice, speaking at schools, I get teens asking that all the time, and I always say joining a critique group is the best way to see your writing improve. And I was in critique groups for years, and with this book, working with somebody else, it really was like having an instant critique group, because they were pointing out the same things in your chapter that if you brought it to a critique group, they would point out the strengths and the weaknesses, and yet they were then helping you refine it. So that's always my best advice.
That's great. Carolyn, anything?
I think that write what you want to read. And that's what we talked about when we were writing The Future of Us. We said, you know, we sort of had a feeling for a book, a story that we wanted to tell that would really make us excited if we were reading it or watching it as a movie, you know, that story. And I think that really kept us going, is that it just felt like something that we would really enjoy if we stumbled on it.
Very sweet. Very sweet. This was a huge pleasure, guys. We're running out of time, but I love it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us on.
This was great. That was Jay Asher and Carolyn Mackler. The book is The Future of Us. It is out now. And what a great story. I've never thought about collaborating on a novel before. But so successfully. That was fantastic. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.